Yes, I'm Charlotte Henry, and I have to start this week with multiple apologies. The first one is that the producer of the show, i.e. me, was a complete plonker and uploaded the wrong audio file at the beginning of last week. So if you listen to it maybe over the weekend, you're probably a bit confused that Emma and I had gone back in time, but it's there. You can go back and re-download it and listen to us. The other apology, and this is particularly for you, co-host Emma, hello.
Hello.
Is that we're going to have to talk about Brexit this week. I know. I'm really sorry, but luckily we've made it better because we have John Elledge here, the esteemed political commentator. Hello, John. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well. How are you?
I'm good. Thankfully, none of the WhatsApp exchanges between Emma and I have made it into the public domain. So far, we're all right.
Charlotte, you are the least of my worries.
I was trying to be generous. It was your text I was much more worried about. I do think
if you're not worried about your WhatsApps getting into the public domain, you're not living an interesting enough life, I have to say.
Well, that is our... I'm guilty as
charged. Honestly, some of the things I've texted about, to colleagues about previous bosses with whom I'm very good friends, I'm like, oh, God.
Well, I look forward to the Emma Burnell files shortly. We're going to talk about Brexit, but again, in a kind of horrible case of deja vu, we also have to talk about Sue Gray.
2020 all over again, 2021.
We're stuck in an infinite loop. But Sue Gray has got a new job, not writing reports about Boris Johnson, but as chief of staff to Keir Starmer. Now, I think this is quite a smart appointment. So there's a bit of a convicted controversy. I'm not convinced there is a controversy. There's plenty of examples of civil servants of varying seniority going into political roles. I'm not convinced there's a controversy here, Em.
My initial reaction was as a comms person, and I was like, oh, I can see all the downsides. Oh, they're going to, it downplays the Sue Gray report. Oh, and then I took a step back, and I'm actually writing my first paid edition of my newsletter on this week. Which is actually, I think this is a really smart appointment for both political and, more importantly, organisational reasons. The only problem will be is if she can't do it for another 3 months at shortest and 2 years at longest, one of the reasons that Labour has been needing a chief of staff for a really, really long time has been internal grumbling about how slow everything is in the Labour Party, how much of a bottleneck there is in the leader's office. And that not being sorted out sooner rather than later is an issue, but that's kind of a very second tier issue. Overall, I think there's a controversy because there's a controversy. You know, we live in a world where everything is a controversy. I keep having to have arguments with people about 15-minute cities, for fuck's sake. It's just, you know, people are going to make a controversy out of everything. Given that's the case and the world that we live in, I don't think there's anyone who'd been appointed to this who wouldn't have had a controversial, they would have found something on everyone. So she seems like a really efficient and dedicated, clever and reasonably political person. And I mean that in a small p politics. She seems to be able to play the politics of personal relationships pretty well. And as such, I think that's a good appointment for the role. And I think the Tories are just shooting themselves in their own feet once again by dredging this all up, because all it does is raise the salience of Partygate back.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think,
and I'm sorry, the public hear Partygate and the image that they go to immediately is the Queen sat alone at her husband's funeral while people in Downing Street were throwing up on swings.
Yeah, no, I entirely agree. I think the less times Conservative MPs and the like mention the words Partygate and lockdown, the better for them. John, your take?
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my take. So that's kind of stolen my thunder, hasn't it? I personally am delighted to think that the Tories are now planning to spend the weekend banging on about the Sue Gray report once again, all the while one of their allied newspapers goes on and on about lockdown. It just seems like a terrible way of promoting, reminding everyone of the events of 2020 and 2021 just seems like a really terrible way of persuading anyone that it's a good idea to have the Conservatives in government. The other point really is like, institutional memory is important. Like Sue Gray knows how government works. She knows what buttons to press. She knows, continuity is important. So I think it is not crazy that Keir Starmer, who thinks he's probably going to be prime minister in a couple of years and is probably not wrong, is thinking about that and making sure there is kind of like, there is somebody around in his senior team who knows what was happening two or three years ago and can point out the bare pits that the government's past have already fallen into.
Yeah.
I think it's actually quite a smart appointment.
I definitely see a lot of that. My only caveat to it, and I think generally trying to make this controversy, as I said, is a bit confected. I can see where there's an issue given how much, obviously, you know, John was talking about bear pits. She quite clearly knows where the bodies are buried, let's put it that way. And I can see why that throws up some issues that are going to be ironed out. I don't think that means she shouldn't be given this job. I think it actually shows an amazing ruthlessness about Sir Keir Starmer, actually. But that is obviously a kink that's going to have to be worked out over the coming weeks and months. And we will see how that goes. But, okay, we can't put it off anymore. We are going to have to talk about Brexit because Rishi Sunak ran to Windsor. He's been in Belfast. He's got some kind of deal done. He's gone from let's get Brexit done to let's make Brexit work. And dare I suggest, he might actually have done it with his new take on the Northern Ireland Protocol. It seems at least serious and thought out, which I accept is really the basics of what we would expect. I mean, it's really what the basics we should expect from a prime minister, but he has certainly achieved that. He's clearly worked hard. You and I have mentioned before, Emma, haven't we, how clearly his approach has been less confrontational and more amenable and may yield better results than that of Boris Johnson and David Frost. And that looks like being the case. He's got these green lanes for things that are only staying in Northern Ireland. He's got rid of that controversial border, it seems, in the Irish Sea without a real hard border on the island of Ireland, which obviously, you know, both those things are unpalatable to various groups of people for obvious reasons. None of these things are going to be perfect. And I was a bit confused. There was a lot of talk about sausages, which just doesn't work for me on multiple levels. But anyway, there seems to have been some real and meaningful progress, Emma. Okay, I've broken.
Not the many levels that you were talking about there, dear.
Go on, John, tell me why I'm wrong then while Emma recovers herself.
No, I mean, I promise, I don't think you are wrong. I've written a lot of rude columns about Rishi Sunak because I think he was massively overrated as Chancellor. I think he has the political antennae of a vole for the most part. But he has gone into Northern Ireland and he's done something that I've been wanting Tory leaders to do for literally years at this point, which is to kind of like act like a grown-up, to treat the European Union as a political bloc with its own interests, rather than some kind of monster from Tory nightmares. And he prioritised what is necessary, what is good for trade in Northern Ireland, over what a small group of Tory backbenchers from the ERG or members of the Democratic Unionist Party want. He has prioritised national interest over a couple of right-wing headbangers. So it would be, you know, it would be incredibly ungracious not to say I think he's kind of done a good thing here. Good for him.
But John, I
knew there was going to be about
one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on here was because your tweets about what he said.
A terrible disappointment, I know.
No, your tweets about what Rishi Sunak has said about the benefits of this deal were hilarious and spot on.
I want to come on.
Oh, yeah, I mean, like he did also sort of make this speech about how wonderful it is for Northern Ireland and they now has access to both the UK market and the EU market and that makes it the best place to do business in the world. And it's like, okay, but not only the entire UK, but the entirety of Europe had access to both those things a couple of years ago. And it has been the express policy of your government to undo that. Why are you now standing there and telling us we were better off the first way? And if Northern Ireland can have this, why can't the rest of us have this?
Yeah.
So that is obviously a massive screw up for him. But I'm still quite positive about it because it does kind of like open a crack of light. You know, there is now a possibility that we will all be moving back in that direction in a way I'm not sure there was before this week.
I suspect that is over-optimistic for at least the near to medium term future. But I have to say, when I saw those comments from the Prime Minister, I was a bit like, I think you might have got the comms wrong on this. Don't make your opponents arguments for them. Not, you know, given that he has defined himself as the authentic Brexiteer compared to Liz, you know, the latecomer Liz Truss and all of that over those months. The idea that he was going, but yeah, it's great that you can access both the UK market and the EU single market. Isn't that fabulous? And everyone's going, all the Remain side go, yes, we told you that in 2016. Didn't quite work, I think, how he meant it to.
But John, he's not very good at politics. He's terrible at politics.
Well, we said that. I
mean, the thing that really stays with me about the leadership debates from last summer, and what a joyous summer that was, being stuck indoors with COVID watching some of them. Like in the first debate, he probably came across better than any of the other candidates, but he got a little bit tetchy a couple of times and he kept speaking over women. Those are the problems. Those are the things. And if I was advising him, I'd say, OK, next time, look a bit happier and stop looking like you're annoyed every time a woman opens her mouth. And in the later debates, those things got worse. You know, he's clearly not a man who is actually has anyone around him who's telling him the things he needs to do to sort out his image or how he might come across. For someone who's so obsessed with Instagram, he's clearly not thinking very hard about those things. But I think it is worth separating that out from the fact that, you know, I just felt like this was a more grown-up approach towards Britain's relationship with Europe than we've seen from any of his predecessors recently.
It clearly was. And I think that's kind of, you've summed up actually, John, the best and the worst of Rishi Sunak actually. What he's best at, and we've saw this, I mean, you may say he was overrated as Chancellor, but actually, you know, the detail of furlough, some of it was a mess, but a lot of it he got right. I mean, there was obviously a mess around self-employed.
Lifted it himself from the TUC, the bits he got right. Yeah. But yeah.
You know, the self-employed stuff was difficult and pretty messy. But the point is, he's good at when he has space to get into the detail of things and doesn't have to do the other stuff. I think at Small P Politics, we've said this before, haven't we, Emma? He's not great at that in different ways and needs other people around him to do that. What did you make of it all, Emma?
Yeah, I'm glad that we seem to have a better deal than we had before, that Northern Ireland has gone some progress towards there being a settlement. And I think that this should pass, and it will probably pass really easily, but Labour will vote for it, so it won't not pass if they put it to a vote.
And the SNP have said they'd vote for it, haven't they?
I mean, which SNP?
The one that's sort of still in Westminster. I think the Lib Dems were sort of faffing around, just holding it. Obviously, we know the Northern Irish parties are, but yes, the numbers will clearly be there.
The numbers will be fine. Where I think the concern is, so one of the things I was thinking about the Sue Gray stuff and the fact that Rishi Sunak hasn't just swatted it down and said shut the hell up, is that I feel he slightly feels like he owes the ERG right nutter part of his party a bit of something at the moment to keep them sweet so that they don't oppose this en masse. And that again is a sign that he's not very good at the politics. You know, he's now, you know, the longer he doesn't have this vote, the longer he has to keep trying to get them to make sure that they stay on side. The longer he's stuck there looking like an idiot over lots of other things. And I think, again, on the politics, Rishi Sunak's had a good week. It hasn't massively registered with the public, as far as I can tell, though he's got a small poll bounce. As we all know, the majority British public, which is in English constituencies, don't vote on Northern Ireland. It's not going to be the thing that they go, oh, you know what, but this Northern Ireland deal, not so sure. Where I think it could pay off for him a little in the long run is that it plays into that right or wrong sense of him as a good manager, someone who is on the saner end of the Tory spectrum. And that, I mean, when you say helps, they're 25 points behind. There's only so much help that him being not Boris can give them. But I think it does play to what strengths he has and what hand he has.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's the, I've got things done. I've done it calmly and sensibly and in a grown-up manner, because really, and it should, as a general, will make things better for a part of the UK and maybe the UK as a whole. And I think that's as good as it gets. And the only way, the win, of course, is if there are multiple, you need multiples of these things, because you're right, the next UK general election is not going to be defined on the Northern Ireland Protocol, although it, you know, it might not even, I mean, the Northern Irish parties will obviously have to deal with it during any kind of election campaign, but that's a slightly different thing. So I think that's right, that it's whether or not there are multiples of these, like, significant, but probably not very sexy to the public wins. John, you're looking like you want to come in and tell me something.
No, I just keep thinking of the, I think there are potentially, and this is a hostage to fortune, I know, but I think there are potentially some John Major parallels to be had here, in that if you look at the polling from the mid-90s, when Major was more popular than his party, and he had been allowed, in retrospect, despite overseeing a government that was completely bloody terrible and seemed to be such at the time, he's been sort of granted this sort of statesman status in retrospect, and seen as this guy who, like, well, you know, he was a good man trying to do his best in a situation where nobody could have managed better, blah blah blah. I think moves like this, if the polls are correct, moves like this, the best case scenario for Sunak is that they kind of put him on that track. They kind of mean that history will judge him as you know, the decent chap who came in at the end and couldn't put this sort of rabble back together, but did as well, but did as statesmanlike a job as he could. I think that's an entirely plausible outcome for him personally. But you guys are right. Nobody is shifting their vote because of Northern Ireland. People care about their energy bills. They care about food and price inflation. Yeah. They care about the fact that people can't get a house, or the state of public services. And none of those things are on the track to being fixed right now. Maybe if this works really well and our economic links with Europe start ramping back up, then that could give us a teeny tiny economic boost. But I don't see how that's coming on stream in time for the next election. I don't think this actually changes. It just meant a few days better press, and now we're already back into talking about Partygate and lockdown again. And so I suspect that's already behind us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think the parallels with Major are interesting, because there's a, you know, conversation that people who think about politics far too much, that massively includes me, are having. Is this 92 or is it 97? The thing about 92 is that Black Wednesday happened after it. The thing about now is Liz Truss has happened. The Liz Truss government is the political equivalent of Black Wednesday in the 90s, and that complete loss of the Conservatives' economic reputation is not going to be recovered in time for the next election. It's just not. They elected a mad headbanger who drove our economy off a cliff, and all our mortgages went up, or our rents went up because our landlord's mortgage went up. So, you know, that's the reality of these things. Rishi Sunak's going to have a few good days. That's politics. That happens. Politics isn't black and white. There are going to be times when he gets stuff right. There are going to be stuff that when he does stuff I don't think is right, but is successful. But even if he gets all of that, I think the fundamentals are just set now.
Yeah, as you know, I'm a bit in agreement with you on Liz Truss, but not 100% in agreement with you on the, like, long-term fallout of Liz Truss, but we will see that. The thing that I think does have some long-term... Well, there's two things I want to pick up. The Tories went away for an away day after this to try and lift their spirits. And guess who managed to get in front of a TV camera? I was going to do the Eminem Guess Who's Back Again thing, but, you know... But yes, Boris Johnson managed to reappear and was obviously hacked. We were all waiting desperately for his opinion on this Windsor framework. Of course we were. And he seems to be not that impressed. Quite obviously what he's trying to do is spark some kind of rebellion within the Conservative Party, when Rishi Sunak seems to have done a pretty good job of placating that for the time being. You know, he's got Steve Baker, who, by the way, if you haven't read it, gave a really wonderful interview on his mental health in the Times. You should read, if you can read that, it's quite a wonderful insight. Really powerful. But, you know, he's got people in his government like Steve Baker in the Northern Ireland office. So he has sort of united the Conservative Party in lots of ways on this. And I think they were went off on their away day feeling pretty positive. And that, I think, also feeds into the point you guys are making about the election. Because obviously, if you have a very miserable parliamentary party and miserable MPs out campaigning, that gap comes over as well. So some of the internal stuff, I think, does matter. But Boris Johnson just wants to be prime minister again, doesn't he, Emma?
Yeah, Boris Johnson is only out for Boris Johnson. And actually, when you say he's trying to whip up a rebellion, he's flirting, as always, with ripping up a rebellion rather than actually going, hey, guys, let's have a rebellion. Because this has landed better than I think he expected, and because the even the you know the real headbangers are part from, well, there's two lots of headbangers who have a role in this. There's the Boris Johnson, we nobody but Boris crew, that is Nadine Dorries, Jacob Rees-Mogg, that lot. Then there's the ERG, which is Brexit means something completely insane that is absolutely completely uneconomically workable, and we will not accept anything other than that. The latter group have kept quite quiet, and the former group have no credibility, even with quite a lot of the internal Tory party. So I think that Boris Johnson is certainly just out for himself, but even he is not going full throttle, because if he does and he fails, he doesn't like to fail publicly.
No, well, we saw that, didn't he, when Michael Gove the first time finished his leadership ambitions. He was obviously deeply resentful, that speech outside Downing Street when he resigned as prime minister. He was obviously deeply resentful about that.
When the cabinet were all resigning that day back last summer, I was driving back from Canterbury. I've been in Canterbury for the day, and I got a BBC text alert on my phone, and I was on the motorway, and I was like, right, I'm sorry, I have to go and see what this is, because they hadn't been alerting for all of the resignations because there were so many. So I pulled into a service station and Michael Gove had been sacked, and I just sat in my car weeping with laughter at how petty that was.
Yes. And again, that speech outside Parliament, I think petty, outside Downing Street, could have been described as petty. But I think your description of the kind of flirting is quite a good one, Emma, because he never quite takes a swing at it, doesn't it? I mean, again, that infamous two articles at the Telegraph for whether he's going to back Brexit or not, all that kind of stuff. John, what's your take on the possible return of Boris Johnson?
It's the theatre of it drives me nuts. Like all these people in the lobby pretending it's like, oh,
you're talking about
Boris
the journalist.
Johnson says, sorry, I'm going to start ranting about that. Sorry. but all these people go, oh, well, Boris Johnson says he has concerns about what the deal makes. No, he doesn't. He obviously doesn't. We all know he doesn't. There is nobody out there who believes for a moment that he's actually concerned about what this means for trade or Northern Ireland or even for Brexit. What he cares about is whether or not this provides him with a chink of an opportunity to worm his way back into Downing Street. And everybody knows that. But for some reason, like our convention is that, like, you know, lobby reporters will report it straight as if he is genuinely concerned about the policy issues. And it drives me mad.
No, it's a huge
like nobody problem. Ever just tells the truth.
I mean, you get all of the bits around lobby reporting where they do say this stuff, and journalists like you and me say it, and get it on the podcast and the analysis bit. But yeah, there is a real problem, because basically Tories who are willing to lie, or any politician who's willing to lie, know that that lie will be reported in a straight-faced way. And that's not okay.
Well, you two both know that I could have endless discussions about political journalism and how the lobby works, but let's keep it on the deal. We think it will get through Parliament.
Yeah.
And I think...
No.
Exactly. Once Labour said they were backing it. It is surely better then than what was before, which was, let's be honest, a complete mess. You had tons of paperwork. You had, a sense in the unionist community that Northern Ireland was cut off from Great Britain, and that led to all sorts of standoffs within Stormont. We hope, get, Stormont working again properly now. This has surely got to be a good way forward, hasn't it, John?
I think so. I mean, like, we kind of like, any of us who say they have a, I think if any of us say that we have like a very, very clear idea of what it was like before and what it's like now, are probably lying to ourselves. But I think the direction of travel is clearly to ease of exporting and, you know, less paperwork and so on. And that's got to be a good thing. But as we were saying a few minutes ago, that does also serve to highlight the absurdity of the fact that if you want to get goods between Great Britain and the European Union now, there are all sorts of barriers that we spent decades, literally decades, dismantling, and we've now thrown them back up again. And this is going to have a horrible impact on the domestic economy. I do think that it probably won't happen under this government, but I do think the pressure is going to keep up to gradually rebuild much of our relationship with the European Union piece by piece, because it is now clear what those benefits were of, you know, faster transit through airports or faster transit of goods across the channel. Those the benefits we've lost are going to become increasingly obvious. So there is going to be pressure to kind of come up with all sorts of mini bespoke deals. And I wouldn't be surprised if in 10, 15 years time, we have something that looks much more like single market and customs union membership than we have now.
Yeah, you might well.
I think that's inevitable, really. It's just a case of finessing it. And that finessing is what the next 10 years will end up being about.
I think...
A waste of time.
Well, look, we don't need to really skip Brexit, because if nothing else, no one on this show is going to give a particularly different response to we wanted to remain. So, but I do think what this builds on and what comes next after this deal is quite interesting, because Rishi Sunak has obviously broken through in one way or the other, where, you know, the EU were prepared to concede stuff, Britain had to concede stuff. Obviously, there's still a bit of the European courts will have influence on this. As we said last week, there wasn't really a choice with that, was there? But, you know, there obviously is a lot of progress being made just by behaving properly and behaving like a grown-up politician.
Diplomatic diplomacy would be better than just being a complete dickhead.
Right. So there has been, you know, levels of progress because of that. And there's obviously a better relationship between von der Leyen and Rishi Sunak than there was, obviously, between Boris Johnson and David Frost and those people. So I wonder what will come next. Will there be better deals and agreements with the EU that ease some of the initial pressures, even though I don't think there's going to be anything that looks like a remain to the single market? What do you think, John?
I think we probably do get quite a long way just by the fact that we are clearly moving into a phase in which it is now acceptable to talk about the European Union as you know, a political bloc rather than a monster. And kind of like, and to say, just like so much of the discourse the last 7 years has been that anything that the EU might want, any step towards their interests, must ipso facto be damaging to the UK and show that you are in some way a Remainer, secretly anti-Brexit or so on. And that has severely limited the room for manoeuvre of maybe someone like Theresa May, who I'm not a fan of, but who clearly was trying to come up with a Brexit deal that wasn't completely disastrous. And many of the constraints on her movement there were the fact that if she took a single step in that direction, there would be absolute lunatics to her right kicking off about the slightest thing. It feels like we moved into a new phase where it is possible to ignore those people. And that can only be a good thing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, listen, in the same way I never like to underestimate the ability of the Labour Party to split into various factions, I never like to underestimate the ability of the Conservative Party to have a row over Europe. So only time will tell on this. But I think he may have done, for at least the short term, a rather decent job of calming things down. We will obviously, I'm sorry, John, to tell you this, but we will have to be on Boris Johnson watch on this show. Because I know, I'm sorry, but you know what's going to happen.
You know that we did end the last iteration of this show because we just got sick of talking about Brexit.
Hope we don't have to talk about Brexit for a while. In fact, should we make a promise, Emma, that next week's episode
No Brexit allowed.
No Brexit, whatever happens. Yeah. Even if you and I just come and talk about the manicures we've had and the films we've watched in a week, that's what we'll do that show.
We can talk about flirting again. I'll give you my theory of plausible deniability, which is how Boris Johnson flirts.
I'm looking at the clock. I mean, you're such a temptress, Burnell.
That, baby.
Because I'm looking at the clock and we do have to bring the show to an end. But, you know, you've left it tantalising. So, right, make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts so that you make sure you get next week the Emma Burnell theory of flirt, plausible deniability flirting. I shudder to think what that's going to sound like. John, thank you so much for joining us. Tell people where they can keep up with all your fantastic work.
I'm a New Statesman columnist. I have a Substack, which is just john.substack.com, called The Newsletter of Not Quite Everything, and the paperback edition of my second book, Conspiracy, A History of Bollocks Theories and How Not to Fall for Them, co-written with the adorable Tom Phillips, is out next month.
Oh, good. Well, you know, as you know, I'm a big fan of any book about fake news and conspiracy theories. Maybe we'll link to both of ours, John, in the show notes, and we'll make sure we link to all your other work. Emma Burnell, we know where to find you. Just remind people quickly.
I'm on Twitter at Emma Burnell _, and I also have a Substack. The first paid edition is going out this weekend, so thank you very much to my lovely paid subscribers. May many more of you come along. And that's Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
And I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on Twitter, and my podcast and Substack is theaddition.substack.com. Do please join me over there for all sorts of media and tech talk as well. We will see you next week. We promise there'll be no Brexit.